Hello and welcome to The Pioneers, brought to you in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. This series explores some of the most innovative ideas in science, technology, conservation, medicine and beyond that are making the world we live in a better place. Today we meet French-born and now Lausanne-based Dr. Grégoire Coutine, whose life-changing wireless implant is sending literal shocks around the experimental medicine community. Having originally been trained in physics and maths, Coutine's approach to medicine is as engineer come doctor, and what he's designed is a sort of bridge installed into the spine of paraplegic patients. The implant is connected to a computer that sends electronic signals to the body, ultimately allowing the paralysed patient to regain some motor functions. Impressive, no? We'll let Coutine explain the exact science behind it, but the significance of this science is incredible. He makes it clear that this isn't a cure for paralysis, but it is an impressive step forward in the treatment of it. It's allowing people who've had no use of their lower body for years to experience being back on 2 feet, even if it's temporary for now. Monocle's Andrew Muller meets Dr. Grégoire Coutine at Rolex's headquarters in Geneva to find out more about his groundbreaking research and what he hopes to do with it.
I guess in the place to start is where we are now. If what the ultimate goal of what you're trying to accomplish is to enable people to recover from spinal injuries, why haven't we got there yet? What has been thwarting us up until this point?
I mean, there have been many obstacles to recovery from spinal cord injury. And the first was the main approach for the past 30 years have been to induce what is called nerve regeneration, growing nerve fibers. Our approach has been completely different. We inverted the paradigm, meaning instead of having really trying to have more nerve connection, we focus on the region of the spinal cord that is below the injury, completely intact, that normally is sufficient to control the muscle of the leg, but because it is disconnected from the brain, it is in a non-functional state, like dormant, right? And then to reactivate this spinal cord, you know, we stimulate them electrically. So it's an approach completely different from the main dogma that has been pursued for the past 30 years.
So what's the simplest way then to explain the difference between somebody who suffers that kind of catastrophic spinal injury now, how they would be treated, and ideally how they would be treated under what you're developing?
Let's be very clear. At this stage, there is absolutely no treatment for spinal cord injury. So spinal cord injury, currently, the only treatment is the management of the consequences of the injury, which are life-threatening.
Yeah.
Right? Then you stabilize the body, the physiology. Then there is a rehabilitation process that is more or less efficient, meaning there is a spontaneous recovery that is typically observed in about half of the patients. And some will never recover, will remain paralyzed for the rest of their life. At this stage, there is no treatment that can be offered to this patient. Indeed, even in our situation, it remains an experimental paradigm. You know, we still don't know whether it will become a commonly available treatment. This is the objective of our research.
In its most basic terms then, and we will hopefully get to the more complicated terms, but in its most basic terms, how does your technique work? What would it consist of?
Basically, 5 centimeters of spinal cord, which is located in the middle of the opaque, is sufficient to control the muscle of the leg to walk. Okay. After a spinal cord damage, the communication between the brain and this region is interrupted. So these 5 centimeters are completely intact, but they are disconnected from the brain. So they are not able to activate the muscle. The way we proceed is that we are going to reactivate these 5 centimeters of spinal cord, provide electricity in a very precise manner in order to reactivate the region that normally controls the leg muscle and thus enable the patient normally paralyzed to perform steps.
So is this electricity delivered by means of a device that's attached or implanted?
So you need to imagine that there's a very delicate opening of the spine, the vertebrae. You slide an electrode array, it's like a second skin, that will come against the spinal cord, that will cover the 5 centimeters of spinal cord that normally control leg muscles. And then this is connected to a mini computer, like a pacemaker, that is implanted in the abdomen. This is kind of a sophisticated piece of technology because this pacemaker can be controlled wirelessly and in real time, yet without any physical connection through the skin. It's really inside the body. And this is essential because it allows you to send this very precise burst of electrical stimulation over the spinal cord to reactivate the spinal cord and enable walking.
And where is that electrical stimulation coming from and how is it controlled?
So currently, the way we have been proceeding for the past 5 years in humans is there's an external computer that visualizes the patient and based on the intended movement of the participant, stimulate to activate the region of the spinal cord that are associated with the desired movement. So to be simple, if someone wants to make a swing of the leg, there is a very small region of the spinal cord that should be activated. If the patient is trying, then the computer program through the video recording see that he's trying to do a swing. Boom! You send a burst of electrical stimulation over this very concise region, and that's enabled the patient to perform the movement. And then you have to, you know, organize some kind of symphony of burst of stimulation that is a symphony of walking in order to make this successful.
So far, what have the practical trials of this process consisted of?
So, I mean, in our case, we are in the very first steps of this process. Steps meaning 7 paralyzed participants who had a spinal cord injury at least 3 years before the enrollment in our clinical trials have been implanted with this pacemaker. With the stimulation on, while they are paralyzed, they can take steps, which, you know, it's always a very important moment for them because, you know, our recent participant, imagine, he has been paralyzed for 10 years.
It must be an absolutely incredible moment for them.
It was for them and for the team because, you know, when you observe this for the very first time, it was clearly very rewarding. But then the next step for these participants, I want more, right? They're hungry,
yeah.
Of course, to recover even better. Then start the second phase of the process, which is rehabilitation. So the idea of rehabilitation, everybody's very, you know, aware of the idea that if you have some kind of neurological impairment, you go to a rehabilitation center and you're going to do some physical training. And this process enables some recovery by reorganizing the central nervous system. This is dependent on activity. But someone who is paralyzed has no activity because he's paralyzed. But suddenly, because we stimulate, we enable paralyzed individual to generate activity, meaning to really be engaged intensely in the rehabilitation process. The consequence was a second surprise for us. And I still remember this was one of the key moments of my career, when one of was a second participant, 7 years, wheelchair bound. He came to the lab in the morning and he said, "You have to look at this." So he was on the bed. He said, "Look at my toe." And he started moving his toe, like winkling his toe, which he has not been able to move for 8 years. And there was no stimulation, which means that through this process, we were able to grow some new nerve connection in order to enable him to regain volitional control over his previously paralyzed muscles.
It must be quite an intense relationship between your team and those 7 subjects you're talking about. I wouldn't even begin to pretend to be able to imagine, one, what it must be like to feel like you're never going to be able to walk again, and then after a long period of that to think, maybe this might be possible? How difficult a relationship is that to manage?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So there are 2 questions within your question, I would say. The first one is, you know, it's really a partnership. We, at this stage, I mean, we had only 7 participants so far. So it's a journey that we are taking together. We're exploring a new continent. Maybe it is possible to recover from paralysis. And it is not a magic pill. You know, there's a surgery, recovery from the surgery, optimization of stimulation program, and then a long daily rehabilitation with intense physical therapy. So it's hard. We ask a lot from the patient. So we need to really work together in order to achieve this entire program of recovery. Then the second part of your question is the calibration of the expectation, because clearly this is not a cure for paralysis. You are not going to see someone coming in a wheelchair and living just walking like you and me. The goal here is to improve recovery, improve quality of life, provide a beginning of a treatment for people who have been told that there is no treatment for them.
Mm.
And this is very important within the many months that the patients stay with us, and even before the surgery, that we calibrate this expectation so that they don't enroll with, let's say, excessively ambitious objective when they go through this repair program.
Is part of it, I guess, do you have a sense from them that they feel like that they're not necessarily thinking of this in terms of something that will enable them to walk out of here as anybody would, but that they're doing this for other people in future who may be in a similar predicament, that they see themselves as part of an evolving process?
This has been a feedback that some of our participants gave us, in the sense that they say, well, we worked very hard and we understood so many things, and I really hope it will benefit to future participants and future patients. And it will, because the learning curve in our program has been very steep. Each participant will learn more, we optimize our technology, and we are more and more efficient delivering the therapy and more successful in the outcome.
I want to go back to the beginning of this, and I guess the beginning of your involvement with this project and with this idea. What was your background? How did you come to this?
So my background is in math and physics,
mm.
but I've always been very much involved in sport. This is why at some point I decided that I wanted to understand how the brain controls movement. And through this research, I've been confronted to people who have lost the capacity to move. And at the time, I was in Los Angeles, actually, at UCLA as a postdoc. And I was facing, you know, young boys, often my age, who had sport accidents. So I could very much relate to their condition with my background. And I was working with the Christopher Reeve Foundation. It was a time when Christopher Reeve was still alive. So it was an important inspiration for me to decide to dedicate my life to finding a cure for paralysis. It was 20 years ago.
And at the time, 20 years ago, did you feel then and do you feel now like you're approaching this still as a physicist and a mathematician as opposed to, as might be expected, a doctor or a surgeon?
Absolutely. And it was a key of the success. The key biological repair approach is to put stem cells, to try to grow new nerve fibers, so a very biologist or medical doctor approach. Instead, I'm like thinking, I'm an engineer, so how can I talk to the spinal cord with my engineering tool, which allows us to completely reverse the paradigm, right? So the idea is completely different. We did exactly the contrary to all the main dogma, the people who are developing treatment for spinal cord injury. Try to have a very pragmatic approach to recovery. And actually, it was Christopher Reeve was always telling the scientists, you know, you really need to be pragmatic. Go to the rehabilitation center and look at the patient fighting to take a step, struggling to maintain their trunk. And then when you go home, think what I will change in my life tomorrow to make their life better. And I always had this in the back of my mind, a pragmatic approach that is realistic based on the tools that are available. So instead of approaching the problem by trying to regenerate the spinal cord, which I thought was too difficult, I thought, okay, let's reactivate the spinal cord electrically because it's intact. There's no reason why it would not be functional. Then spend a lot of time to understand the scientific mechanism. How does it work when you deliver the stimulation? We optimize everything and understood better and better to the point that, you know, few paralyzed persons now are able to take voluntary steps, at least in the lab.
When this idea occurred to you of, as you put it, reversing the paradigm, and you started explaining it or communicating it to medical professionals, was there any resistance to it or pushback to it or people, I guess, even being unable or unwilling to think about it in a new way?
There have been tremendous pushback because the community of spinal cord injury is dominated by this idea that you need to have nerve regeneration to observe recovery. And we approached the problem in the opposite way. We had success with paralyzed rats running again. But, you know, medical doctors are always very reluctant to consider therapy developing rats as a potential success for human beings. And for many years, I had a lot of pushback, and it was very, very difficult to actually reach the clinic until I met a key person, a female neurosurgeon, which is fairly rare, actually, especially in Switzerland, who really believed in this idea. She felt that I said, every day job is to perform surgical intervention, to put electrodes in the brain of people with Parkinson's disease over the spinal cord to alleviate pain. So she's used to use electricity as a treatment. And then she thought, I mean, it makes sense to me. This is some approach I'm comfortable with. Then we went into a partnership. Then she opened the door of the hospital, and it became suddenly possible to test this idea in people.
Especially in the face of that pushback or that bafflement, and given the fact that you're approaching this from a non-medical background, what I'm interested in is where you found the strength and the will to keep going at not what just is a medical problem, but it's one of the big ones, allowing paralyzed people to walk again. This is serious Holy Grail variety stuff. Mm-hmm. At how easy or hard was it to keep convincing yourself, no, I of all people can fix this. I think I can make progress here. Because it's one thing to have the idea, and then it's the other to decide, yep, I should definitely do this.
Well, I mean, you certainly need to have the drive. And the key, I think, in life, you are very lucky when you wake up in the morning and you know why you're going to walk to your job, because it's your passion. And my passion is science, and especially my life goal is to develop a treatment against paralysis. And when you have understood this, many things become a lot easier, because then you can organize the next year, the next 5 years, the next 10 years with this life goal, which is exactly what I've been doing for the past 20 years, with a succession of milestones that was always planned. I always knew what was the next step in order to eventually reach where we are now, mm-hmm. but also where I want to be in 5 years, because I have a lot of ideas which I hope will translate into impacting the life of people with paralysis.
In terms of where we can get to, is it conceivable at all, in whatever timescale you want to name, that a spinal cord damage could start to become thought of as something as repairable as, I don't know, a broken arm or a broken leg is now? Or is that just not a helpful way of thinking about it?
No, this is not helpful. We need to really calibrate expectation. We are still very far from a cure or even a very robust treatment. So there are two aspects. A spinal cord injury has very different form and severity. If the lesion is incomplete, with our approach, if we act early after the injury, I think we'll have a lot of impact. And that's what I'm trying to demonstrate. That will be the next step that we start next year. In that case, that would really change the life of people. They might recover to an extent that was previously thought impossible.
Like, what kind of extent would we be talking about in a best case scenario?
Well, the hope is that some of the patients will hardly be able to walk independently, will be able to really walk, maybe with crutches, maybe even without crutches. This is what I want to reach. Now, if the patient has a very severe injury, this will not be sufficient. They will be able to walk in the laboratory. The stimulation, I think, will enable them to continue their training. And this is very important to enable your body to be in a better physiological state and have a better life for a longer time in a better conditions. But it will not be sufficient. So this is one piece of the puzzle, I think, toward the treatment that will need to involve biological repair intervention, meaning at some point it will be important to have maybe stem cells and other type of molecules to have more tissue, more nerve, together with what we are doing. At that moment, maybe we will see a breakthrough in the treatment against paralysis.
Where you are right now, at a day-in, day-out level, how many people do you have working on this? And I'm sure that there isn't a typical working day as such, but what are you mostly working on right now?
I mean, this is no large endeavor that involves, in my laboratory, there are about 50 people focusing on developing different approaches, actually, for recovery. And I'm also collaborating with a startup involving 70 people that are developing technology to really make this a commonly available treatment. So, it's about 100 persons who are working hard to make this a treatment in the future.
I want to be able to give listeners a sense of the progress you've thus far made. So of those 7 subjects you've been working with, if we could maybe reduce them down to one representative one, and if you could just kind of explain where they've been able to get to from the first day you met them via whatever treatment they've had to what they can do now, any change or improvement in their condition.
I would actually give you 2 examples, if you don't mind. The first one is the category of people, a few of them, who have what we call an incomplete spinal cord injury. What does it mean? They had some residual control over the activity of their muscles. So a little contraction, not sufficient to be able to walk. But clearly, you know, if you have a residual contraction of your muscle, it means that something is going through. These individuals have shown remarkable progresses. So with the stimulation, they are able to walk for hundreds of meters outside the lab with crutches. And they have improved the control of the previously paralyzed muscle without stimulation, meaning there is a neurological recovery, the growth of new nerve connection that improve the communication between the brain and the spinal cord. So for example, some of our participants had one leg completely paralyzed. Mm-hmm. They could not activate a single muscle of the leg. And now they can activate every single muscle of the leg and move the leg voluntarily and stand without stimulation. So it's a massive improvement for them. And in their daily life, it means many more activities they can perform. Then there's a second group of participants who came with what we call motor complete paralysis. They cannot activate a single muscle of both legs. Of course, you can imagine that the lesion is much more severe in this case. These individuals can all walk very nicely in the lab with the stimulation on. When you turn it off, they have very little residual control. So they are dependent on the stimulation in order to have some kind of functional movement.
But the stimulation does make a difference enough that it allows them to have some functional movement where previously they had none.
I wish, you know, the auditor could actually see the video and see a paralyzed patient actually walking very nicely with the stim on, and then you turn it off and suddenly the leg becomes like two flaccid entities because they cannot activate at all. You turn it back on and immediately, up, they will stand and they resume their walking pattern continuously. It looks like a miracle when you see it, really.
Kind of is a miracle, really.
I mean, at the same time, you need to calibrate expectation because remember that it's only with the stimulation, there's a body weight support system, there are a lot of technology that are enabling this recovery. So it's not sufficient. But, you know, this is showing you the potential for recovery. And it's also very important because it brings hope, and with the hope, maybe we'll attract more people to work in this field of research, and hopefully investors also to invest in this line of research to make it a treatment eventually.
On that subject, one of the reasons that you are now a Rolex laureate is that, you know, improving life in general on the planet is one of Rolex's perpetual values. So from where you've got to now, and that progress, as you've outlined, it has already been considerable, how do you see Rolex's support for what you're doing helping out over the next few years?
We are already helped in many ways. Through the process of the Rolex Award, we had many interactions with scientists, people in the jury of the Rolex Award that challenged me in thinking about technology that would, in a way, meet the expectation of Rolex value, which actually encouraged me, forced me somehow to develop a technology that is more appropriate to reach many, many people. And so I changed my approach over the past 2 years. And now I think we have a much more realistic way to approach the next step of the treatment. Of course, on top of this, what I really appreciate with the support from Rolex is that Rolex put a stamp on paralysis, emphasizing that this is very important to fight paralysis, to support people who, as you say, that this crazy idea that it's actually possible, maybe, to resolve this problem, which is one of the greatest problems of humanity in medicine, if you think about it. And I think it's important because from the outside world, one may think that, of course, it is so important to solve paralysis. Now, if you look concretely in the field of science and investors, this is a niche. There are not that many people who are paralyzed across the world. So it's actually difficult to receive support for this type of research.
So in that respect, has the announcement of the Rolex Award and you becoming a Rolex laureate, has that had a big impact on the project and on you personally?
So the Rolex Award did bring visibility on the project, on my team in a way, in the sense that I think we are receiving more support than we used to have to move forward at the academic institutional level here in Switzerland when we operate this research program.
That was Dr. Grégoire Coutine, who is one of Rolex's 2019 laureates. Over the coming weeks on The Pioneers, we'll be meeting more of the innovators whose bright ideas are changing the world we live in, including Kriti Karanth next week, whose conservation project is ensuring better relationships between humans and animals in places where both are harming the other. But until then, thanks for listening.